Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas. This week, I'm joined by Rachel Cockerell, author of Melting Points, a history-weaving memoir, documentary and literature. And it's a brilliant and fascinating portrayal of the search for a Jewish homeland at the turn of the 19th century and beyond, seen through the prism of one family, her family. So, Rachel, where does your story begin and how does it end?
Thanks so much for having me. Maybe I'll take those questions in reverse order. It ends with my family. My dad was born in 1940 and grew up in a sort of slightly crumbling, ramshackle house in North London with his siblings, his cousins, his parents, his cousin's parents, his grandmother and his great aunt. And his mother had come to England as a Russian Jewish immigrant as a child. So all the adults in the house spoke Russian. And it was this kind of, some family members have described it as a slightly mad sort of immigrant house that my dad grew up in. And I heard lots of stories about this house growing up, and I just became sort of slightly obsessed with it. Mm. So the story ends there. But I wondered, when I was starting to write this book, I wondered how and why my family came to England when they did. And it sort of had these roots that seemed to go deeper and deeper. I kept on tracing the story back further and further. And somehow the story of this Russian Jewish family coming to England starts with Zionism, with the founding of Zionism, and with Theodor Herzl, who is kind of nothing to do with my family. My great-grandfather crossed paths with him a few times, but Herzl is sort of the main character at the beginning of the book.
Yeah. So the first stages, we start with Theodor Herzl, at the first Zionist congresses in those late years of the 19th century, first years of the 20th century. And you get that sense of kind of hope and idealism, but also desperation. And a very famous pogrom of Jews carried out in Eastern Europe in modern-day Moldova, but then the Russian Empire at Kishinev, and that goes around the world. Could you kind of give us a picture of the events of that time, that sense of desperation, and also the sense of destiny that I think people started to have as well about Jewish aspirations?
I think Herzl himself had more of a sense of destiny than desperation. He was very much an assimilated Jew living in Vienna, as you said, at the turn of the century. He was a beloved and charismatic journalist, sort of part of Viennese high society, and would sort of go to parties and go to the theatre and be sort of adored everywhere he went. All his jokes were always laughed
and
at.
And he's physically very attractive. He's got kind of, everyone talks about his bearing.
Yes, sort of king-like bearing. Very handsome, tall, or at least tall for 1900, and always very well-dressed. And people were sort of irresistibly drawn to him.
Yeah, and there's that fascinating little anecdote. He wanted everyone at the first Zionist congresses to be in white tie at any time of the day.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, you know.
He said that white tie gives a sense of solemnity and gravity. And he thought, I guess jumping ahead a bit to the first Zionist congress, he thought that Jews coming from all around the world, if they were wearing sort of summer dress, as he described it, then they would be too jovial. And he wanted them to feel serious. And for this occasion of the first gathering of Jews from across the world, to sort of have weight to it. But before that, he was just a journalist. He wrote about the triviality of writing his columns. And actually, he saw the idea of founding a modern Jewish homeland in Palestine as perhaps his destiny, and as a way for him to sort of carve his name in the history books, which he did, but didn't quite go according to plan.
Yeah, so he sort of becomes this prophet of Jewish liberation. But tell me about how that aspirations liberation actually develops. How do people debate it? What do they think is achievable? And what's going on in the wider world at that point? I'm really struck by those congresses, how globalised this world seems to be. Jews coming from all over the world, talking about events which are very far off geographically, but seem very close, very, very present.
Yeah. So Herzl originally appeals to his fellow assimilated Jews of Vienna and says, you know, perhaps we should pack up our bags and move to Palestine. It's the sort of solution to the Jewish question. And as Stefan Zweig, who's a sort of young acolyte of Herzl, writes, the Jews of Vienna sort of turned and laughed at Herzl. You know, his friends said to him, is this meant to be a joke, this idea of going to Palestine? And so Herzl at first sort of thought he had failed and he should just return to his trivial journalistic work. But then the answer came back, and the answer was not from the Jews of Vienna or the sort of cultured Jews of Western Europe, but from the Jews of the Eastern European ghettos in the Russian Empire. And word of this idea of a return to Palestine spread from town to town and village to village. And people put up pictures of Herzl in their house. People who had never seen him, had never, you know, met anyone who had ever met him, sort of thought of him as this sort of mythical figure. So when Herzl convenes the first Zionist Congress, it is these Jews from all across the world. And I think people comment at the time that there's not really much of a sense of unity between them. Mm-hmm. They're all dressed very differently. They're all speaking different languages. You know, Yiddish is, of course, prominent, but there's also, you know, German and Polish and Russian, and also a few American Jews are there, English Jews. It's just, you know, this very disparate group of people from all across the world.
Yeah.
And as you said, there's this pogrom in Kishinev. Around 50 people were killed, around 50 Jewish people were killed by Russians around Easter. And
it's on Easter Sunday, wasn't it?
Yes, although all the calendars are different, yeah, so it's all, who knows.
But how horrifying. That.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, it's, as people at the time say, it's this small event, sort of to quote Chamberlain many years later, of a faraway land of which we know little. And yet it's the word of this pogrom sort of spreads across the world. And, there are huge protests all across America. In England, it's on the front pages of all the newspapers. Mm. And the Jews of Kishinev, you know, say things like, may God grant that I will soon be able to turn my back upon this bloody country. So it's sort of the first tangible evidence of the 20th century that the Jews need to escape the Russian Empire, find a way out either to America or to Palestine or to somewhere else. And yeah, that's really the beginning.
So that phrase, somewhere else, is key. And there's a fascinating scene early on where Theodor Herzl meets the then colonial secretary, Joe Chamberlain, who's a great figure in British politics in his own right. But there's this meeting and it starts off something for Herzl and for the Zionist movement. What happens?
Herzl writes in his diary, I'm thinking of creating a closer territorial goal and preserving Zion as the final goal. You know, we were talking earlier about this idea of desperation. There was a thought that, as Zionists said at the time, perhaps the gates of Palestine will remain closed for many decades to come, so we could find a temporary promised land to sort of wait for Palestine. Herzl approaches the colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, father of Neville. He was much more famous than Neville in his time, and I think would be quite outraged that he has become the less famous Chamberlain.
Yeah, and had many more achievements than Neville.
But, yeah. The superior Chamberlain.
Yeah.
Herzl didn't really think much of Chamberlain. Chamberlain was the colonial secretary, and Herzl described him as like being the shopkeeper of a junk shop, not quite sure what was in stock, i.e. not quite sure what colonies were in British possession.
But that is such a great description of the British imperial mentality,
yes,
of this having this world-spanning empire that I think a lot of people didn't know
exactly
a lot about.
Frankly. A world-spanning empire, yeah. Sort of countries and colonies sort of knocking about in the back, sort of gathering dust.
Yeah.
And Chamberlain, like everyone else, was charmed by Herzl and said, more or less, let me sort of look in the back and see what I have for you. Then they met less than a year later, and Chamberlain said, I found somewhere for you. He had taken a train through British East Africa and looked out at the landscape of Kenya and said, oh, this would be perfect for Dr. Herzl. So Herzl met Chamberlain again. Mm. And Chamberlain said to him, I've found a land for you and the Jews, and that's Uganda. It was not Uganda, it was Kenya, but, you know, it was all the same to him.
So Herzl then presents this idea to the next Zionist Congress. And by then he's joined by someone who's a key character in your book and develops into a really important character in your story, someone called Israel Zangwill. Could you tell us a bit about their meeting and what role Zangwill then plays in the Zionist movement, both in tandem with Herzl and then after his death?
Herzl travels to London at the end of the 1890s, and he's told by a few people, oh, you should meet the novelist Israel Zangwill. He might be able to sort of help you get in touch with the British Jews. And Herzl and Zangwill's first meeting is inauspicious. They're sort of polar opposites. Herzl, you know, as we've talked about, is this sort of perfectly well-turned-out, handsome Viennese Jew. And Zangwill is a shambolic British Jew, apparently the worst dressed man in London. One journalist called him the ugliest man in the world, always sort of stumbling around Fleet Street with a pile of manuscripts under his arm, peering short-sightedly into shop windows. And sort of, if he were to cross the road, he would nearly get run over by a horse-drawn carriage.
And he looks like one of these, he's a very striking face. And I love the photographs in your book. It's one of these faces which always looks different from a different angle. It's strange. So I can see how people found him sort of oddly impressive, but then ugly at the same time.
Yes. Actually, a few journalists described him as looking like a gargoyle on a medieval cathedral. The sad thing is that Zangwill sort of read everything that was ever written about him in the press and diligently sort of cut out every article and stuck them in his scrapbook, no matter whether good or bad, mostly bad. So yes, Zangwill was this very distinctive figure. His first visit to America, one journalist said, Mr. Zhang was not a difficult figure to sort of pick out from the crowd. You have seen his pictures, he looks like them, i.e. sort of these horrific caricatures of Zangwill were not far off.
So they go to Basel, and I think we haven't mentioned, but these the Zionist congresses were in Basel, for those who don't know, which I find funny, having been to modern Basel. The kind of atmosphere in the book around the congresses of this city full of kind of Jewish life. Mm-hmm. It feels very far removed from the very quiet and boring home of pharmaceutical industries, I think, that modern-day Basel is. So Zangwill and Herzl go to Basel, and Herzl presents this plan. And Zangwill plays quite an interesting role in making arguments for it. How do those arguments play out, and what's the reaction among kind of world Jewry?
Zangwill sort of falls under Herzl's spell. The first time they meet, you know, Herzl sort of looks at him and sees how shambolic he is. He meets Zangwill in his study and sees this chaotic study with papers everywhere and books everywhere and just sort of chaos everywhere, and says, you know, this study looks like the inside of Zangwill's mind. Herzl doesn't really speak much English at that point, and Zangwill doesn't speak very good German. So they speak in French. Zangwill's French is not particularly good, and Herzl writes in his diary that he's not sure whether Zangwill even understands him. But then Zangwill later makes a speech saying, you know, this black-bearded stranger dropped into my study one day and said, I am Theodor Herzl, help me to rebuild the Jewish state. So they both had slightly different memories of the occasion, but Zangwill becomes Herzl's sort of right-hand man and wants to help him rebuild the Jewish state.
Yeah.
So when Herzl is offered this land in British East Africa, which he feels he has no choice but to present to the Jews, Zangwill sort of supports him to the ends of the earth. Spoiler alert.
Quite literally. As time passes.
Yes. Yeah. The Uganda plan goes catastrophically wrong, and Zangwill sort of feels that the legacy of the Uganda plan is that somewhere we must find a home for the Jews. Yeah. And whether it's Palestine or somewhere else.
I'm really struck by when Herzl does deliver this plan to the Congress, and the most furious reaction is from Russian Jews. And I think, I can't remember which character says it, but it's like they're quite self-conscious. They're like, the energy of Zionism comes from the Pale of Settlements, and that they're not keen is really difficult. Like, that we kind of need them to be into what we're offering.
Yes.
Because that's where the energy is coming from. That's where the demand is coming from.
Yes, the Russian Jews are really the heart of Zionism at the beginning of Zionism. The American Jews have America. They don't have that sense of desperation.
Yeah.
And Jews in France and England and Austria are quite happy to assimilate. It's really the Jews of Eastern Europe that have, as we've talked about, this desperation to get out of the Russian Empire.
Yeah. So as you said, the Uganda plan, they send a party to Uganda to scope it out. It's completely inappropriate for their needs. And there's also an interesting backlash in the UK, where British, you portray it really well in newspaper cuttings. There's lots of commentators who go, you know, why are we giving up parts of our territory to the Jewish people? You know, this could be a good thing for us. It's resource rich, etc., etc. So there's clearly a kind of backlash to the backlash there as well. So after that kind of falls through, there's this kind of restless search for other parts of the world which could fit the bill. Could you give a kind of a picture of what Zangwill then goes on to try and do?
Zangwill eventually leaves Zionism in quite a dramatic fashion.
Yeah.
He and others storm out of the Zionist Congress, if you imagine it's a sort of huge hall filled with a few thousand people. And a faction stands up and storms out and sort of leaves Zionism forever.
Yeah.
And they form a rival movement called the Jewish Territorial Organization, which, if I could go back, I would say to them, please find a better name than that. It's so awful. Everyone keeps forgetting what the name is, and at the time, you know, calling it the Jewish Territorialist Organization or spelling it wrong. Also, it's shortened not to JTO, but to ITO. So it's just confusing, bad, too much jargon.
Yeah, and it was
too many syllables.
I completely agree, because ITO then gets locked onto land as a kind of, you know, we're looking for a land that fits that bill. And when I was reading the book, I kept on going, I can't satisfactorily pronounce that to myself. It's ITO lands or ITO lands.
ITO land, who knows?
It just sounds terrible.
Yeah, they needed a better name.
They needed some PR, yeah.
Yeah, they really needed some PR. Yeah. But the sort of motto of the Jewish Territorial Organization is, if we cannot get the Holy Land, we can make another land holy. And the idea is, if we can't get Palestine, if we can't get Uganda, then let's look for somewhere else.
Yeah.
So Zangwill reluctantly accepts the role of president of the Jewish Territorial Organization. You know, before this, he had been a novelist and a playwright. I'm sure we'll talk about his most famous play. And he's not really a politician or a sort of leader of a, you know, political movement.
And there are plenty of flaws to the way he kind of does leadership, I think. There's kind of moments you think, oh, he played that completely the wrong way around.
Yes.
Or he's sort of not got the long-term vision here. He's new to that kind of political game.
Yes.
In a way that Herzl sort of carries off, because he's just this huge presence.
People think of Herzl as sort of a natural statesman, yeah, that he would fit the role of, you know, the first leader of modern Israel so beautifully.
Yeah.
Whereas Zangwill, I think, is always sort of mismatched in his role of president of this sort of rival movement to Zionism.
Yeah.
But
so Zangwill... what happens then? They're looking for all these places, and it's like, pick the most inhospitable parts of the world, like, you know, Cyrenaica in modern-day Libya, Western Australia, which is basically no one lives there even now, and it just goes on.
Yes, like, Zangwill sort of makes all these speeches saying, there must be a land somewhere on earth that is uninhabited and yet inhabitable.
Yeah.
And so he goes on this quest for an alternative to the Holy Land, and as you said, thinks of Western Australia, thinks of modern-day Libya, modern-day Iraq, Angola, also more inhabitable places like Canada and Mexico, but all these plans fall through for one reason or another, usually because the governments of those countries say having a Jewish colony in Canada, for example, is quite out of the question. Libya and Iraq fall through because, you know, there are no rivers. There's just always a small sort of catch in the plan.
Yeah.
And Zangwill says at the end of, I think it's around a decade of sort of searching for an alternative, that we have knocked on every door and every answer has been no.
And that comes back a little bit, I think, to that sense of a world that's already quite globalised. You know, there really aren't that many places around the world which are inhabitable but uninhabited. It's pretty interconnected. How does America actually solve that problem to a degree for the ITO movement? But how does that create new problems for the movement?
The American Jews sort of catch wind of this slightly crazy idea of finding an alternative promised land, which is the Jewish Territorial Organization's mission. And they sort of watch from afar as it keeps on going wrong and keeps on sort of not working. And eventually, an American Jewish banker called Jacob Schiff, who was sort of contemporaries with people like J.P. Morgan, approaches Zangwill and says, I see that you're trying to find a refuge for the Jews of Eastern Europe. I'm watching as the Jews from Eastern Europe arrive in New York Harbour and settle on the Lower East Side of New York. And I'm watching, so he was sort of watching in horror. He had come to New York in the late 1800s. So he was a sort of longer established Jewish New Yorker. And he was watching all these sort of new immigrants arrive, speaking Yiddish, wearing sort of ragged clothing and not assimilating. They were sort of creating a Jewish ghetto in New York and not melting into the melting pot.
Mm.
So he said to Zangwill, perhaps we could collaborate on a plan to get the Jews out of Russia, get them to America, but not to New York. We could bypass New York altogether.
And that phrase, melting pot, is such a famous phrase. But tell us how it's sort of part of Zangwill's PR campaign to get the scheme going.
Yeah.
And Zangwill writes this play called The Melting Pot and puts it on, and Theodore Roosevelt comes and sees it, and it's this huge event. Can you talk about the ideas there and what Zangwill was trying to do?
Yeah. Zangwill has been largely forgotten. You know, he was once probably the most famous Jewish novelist in the world, And now, you know, over the years of writing this book, telling people, my main character is a novelist called Israel Zangwill, a sort of blank expression would cross their face. And yet everyone uses this phrase, the melting pot, usually to describe New York, but also to describe London. You hear it all the time. And that phrase was coined as a metaphor for New York and London by Zangwill in a play that he wrote in 1908, which was about these two sort of star-crossed lovers in New York. And the sort of moral of the story is how wonderful it is, the American melting pot. Perhaps we should cast off all our old world ways and melt into the crucible that is America and become sort of modern Americans who have no sort of trace of old world life.
Yeah.
So this play is the first sort of modern use of that phrase, the melting pot. And it sort of becomes an event, a huge sort of cultural event. Theodore Roosevelt is in the audience and leads the standing ovation. Mm. Roosevelt, you know, has these ideas. He wrote, you know, in his time about immigrants coming to America and revering only the American flag, not revering any other flag, even second.
And it's a time which has a furious debate about immigration in America post those kind of three decades of massive immigration.
Yeah.
It's really politically charged, I guess.
Yeah,
and that's where Melting Pot comes in. And actually, eventually, this scheme kind of founders on how politically charged it does become. So he does this play, Melting Pot, as part of this kind of campaign. How does that kind of aspiration to get Jews to come to America, how does that actually all work? What's then the process? And the right kinds of Jewish immigration, not the kind of going to into the ghetto and carry out your Yiddish ways.
Yeah.
What's the new process they're going to?
So Schiff offers this prospect of collaboration and Zangwill reluctantly accepts. Mm. He, in the early 1900s, before he's written this play, The Melting Pot, which is almost sort of propaganda for the idea, he speaks publicly about his hatred of America as a Jewish refuge. He says at one point, if I had my way, not a single Russian Jew would enter America. And he says, America is the euthanasia of the Jews. This race will sort of slowly die out if America is the only refuge. So Schiff offers Zangwill this sort of prospect of bringing the Jews to America, but not to New York. And Zangwill's tempted to just say no and to carry on his search for a sort of impossible alternative to the Holy Land. But eventually he reluctantly agrees because he's sort of at a dead end.
And it's an interesting creative friction there, that Schiff then, he almost wants there to be a new kind of Jewishness that is comfortable with being, you know, totally American, really, but also being Jewish in some way, whereas Zangwill is clearly not comfortable. And The Melting Pot, it's hard not to read that play in a kind of quite ironic terms. It's like he's kind of taking the mick out of this idea.
I don't know. For me, it seems that play feels very earnest. I've read a few accounts from playgoers at the time. It was almost sort of proselytizing on stage, these long monologues given by the main characters about how wonderful America is and how wonderful it is, that the great American melting pot, God's crucible, he calls it. And, you know, people comment at the time about how it's sort of earnestness bordering on almost sort of sickly sweet earnestness. And so some people also say, can Zangwill really believe this? Is this propaganda really Zangwill's opinion? Mm. But before that, Zangwill's idea is that the melting pot is a terrible idea. Yeah. So he's this person sort of full of contradictions.
Yeah. So Schiff proposes to go beyond New York. Where does that search end?
So Schiff and Zangwill search down the east coast of America for a port where the Jewish immigrants could arrive, and the city they arrived in would be just unattractive enough that the immigrants arriving there would be quite happy to leave again that day or the next day and head to the American hinterland, as they call it. So they sort of search down the East Coast looking for somewhere suitable, and they land on Galveston, Texas, which most Brits haven't even heard of, let alone visited. It was once one of the most prosperous places in America. It was called the Wall Street of the South, and then was flattened by the most devastating hurricane in American history in 1900, and sort of had a hard time recovering. This was all happening in 1907, this sort of search for somewhere in America for the immigrants to arrive. So that was only 7 years after the hurricane. So it was really still a slightly broken city. And Schiff and Zangwill thought it would be perfect because Jews arriving there wouldn't be tempted to form a Jewish ghetto in Texas. The newspapers at the time did sort of worry about this. You know, they had headlines saying, Zangwill plans new Jewish colony in Galveston, Texas. And Zangwill had to sort of deny these claims. Yeah. But that was the beginning of what is now called the Galveston Movement.
So, you know, this is where your great-grandfather comes into the story, David Jockelman. And I really loved, actually, how he just drops into the story without much fanfare. And I get the sense that's probably what he would have wanted. It's just this kind of slightly shadowy presence. Tell us how crucial he was, actually, to this stage of the story.
He was
And the Jewish story.
He was sort of waiting in the wings, or sort of lurking in the corner of sort of the reader's eye in the story before this point. He was at Herzl's funeral. He was at the early Zionist congresses. But this is the first time he comes out of the shadows. My great-grandfather, David Jockelman, was the one to persuade Zangwill to become president of the Jewish Territorial Organization. I think he himself sort of wanted to do it, but he was too young and too unknown, so he sort of said to Zangwill, it should be you. My great-grandfather was a Russian Jew, and his job, really, when the Galveston movement began, was to sort of travel around the Russian Empire, persuading Jews who were about to set off for New York to go to Texas instead. And, you know, he would say to them how wonderful Texas is, and they would say in response, Texas, but I want to go to America. For them, it was America and New York were sort of interchangeable terms.
Nothing much changed, does it?
Yeah. I mean, they hadn't heard of Texas. They definitely hadn't heard of Galveston. And there were these sort of pamphlets in Yiddish saying, you know, Texas is much better than New York. Very sunny. You'll get a job. You'll have a way better life. Don't bother with New York.
So the Galveston movement gets going, and quite a lot of Jews do go to Galveston. Yeah, I think it's like 10,000.
It's 10,000.
How does that, and we kind of referenced it earlier, why does that come to an end?
The Galveston movement lasts for 7 years. It starts in 1907 and it ends just before the outbreak of World War I in 1914. The founders sort of blamed it on the war, but actually it had sort of ended just before the war. There were all sorts of logistical problems, and it was sort of, you know, much harder to pass all the medical tests. And also it was a much longer journey. You know, if you think of crossing the Atlantic, you know, arriving in New York is one thing, but then taking a left turn down to the Gulf of Mexico, especially, you know, in the early 1900s, added an extra few weeks to your journey, which was not the most pleasant journey.
Yeah.
The founders wanted Galveston to become the place that an immigrant would first think of going in America, so that Ellis Island in New York would sort of become secondary or would sort of fade away. And if you were planning to go to America, Galveston would be the place to go. They wanted 2 million Russian Jews to enter through Galveston, but that didn't happen. It was 10,000. Yeah. So it was for them, it was a sort of a failure, really. But for us, you know, looking back, 10,000, if all those 10,000 had a few children and they had a few children, there are perhaps even hundreds of thousands of Galveston Jews, as they're called, across the American West now.
So that kind of winds up, and David comes to London, to England. And this is really, I guess, where your family history sort of starts to get movement in the story. Tell me how that then develops in London and how it then collides with the tragedy of Jewish history in the 20th century.
Zangwill is actually the one who says to my great-grandfather in 1913, 1914, your future belongs to England. You should come over here and you should bring your wife and children over here. You know, his children included my grandmother, who was called Fanny. And so Jockelman comes to England, buys a house in North London, as many Jews did at that time. And he sort of leaves Galveston and Zionism behind him. I think post-World War I life as an immigrant in London, your life before the war was this sort of distant memory, but it sort of belonged to another world, especially if you've moved continents. So he didn't, as far as I know, he didn't really talk about Galveston or Zionism or Theodor Herzl. And as a result, my grandmother, his daughter, sort of didn't know much about it, or was never really told about my great-grandfather's sort of past life, you know, saving the Russian Jews.
Yeah.
But my great-grandfather then sees the rise of Hitler in the 1930s, and that becomes his life. He organises the biggest Jewish protest that London has ever seen in 1933 when Hitler comes to power. And he writes about this sort of catastrophe which is looming on the horizon, which we must avert. So he sort of watches in horror as Hitler rises.
Yeah, and he gets to know Vladimir Jabotinsky, who's a huge figure in Jewish history. Tell me how Jabotinsky plays a role in that story as well. Because I think that what's really kind of moving about your book is that you get, I guess we'll just come on to that, is the style is quite interesting in that it's documentary style and you use memoir clippings, newspaper cuttings, first-person interviews with your family members as well. But there are quite a few famous names that pop up in the narrative who would be familiar to any educated person, like Stefan Zweig, Arthur Koestler, Chaim Weizmann, Vladimir Jabotinsky. Do you see your book as not just a story of a family, but a kind of palimpsest of Jewish culture as well? It'll weigh into thinking about Jewish culture in that period.
Yeah, I hope it's a sort of 20th century story, that all these sort of figures from the 20th century, both forgotten and remembered, are all sort of jumbled together.
Yeah.
So you'll have a quote from, you know, In Your Eyes and Nobody, and then a quote from Churchill, you know, and then Hemingway makes a cameo.
Yeah.
Theodore Roosevelt makes a cameo. FDR makes a cameo. But yeah, mixed in are these names that you haven't heard of. But then for me, while I was writing, I was sort of looking people up on Wikipedia and finding these long Wikipedia entries about them. So many sort of forgotten figures and remembered figures telling this sort of story of the 20th century.
And Jabotinsky is that. He's almost the most tragic figure because he dies just at the beginning of the Second World War, and he is the most vociferous in warning about the tragedy that's going to happen.
Yes.
I was reading it, I was like, God, that is just so tragic, the way in which he's just right up to his death saying, you know, you've got to get out, it's all going to go wrong.
Yeah, he uses these sort of phrases which are sort of haunting now. He says, Jews of Eastern Europe, you're sort of going about your daily lives worrying about these minor things and you're not seeing what's in store for you. Get out while you still can. You don't realise what's awaiting you. And he says at one point, destruction, learn the word by heart and God grant that I may be mistaken. So, and this is in the 1930s, he says, my hair has turned white and I've been warning you and warning you, you've all got to leave. He talks about an evacuation of Eastern Europe, and he's sort of not listened to, as I think anyone at that time warning about the horrors in store was not listened to. You know, that people were sort of thought of as being dramatic, and you know, the whole Hitler and anti-Semitism thing would blow over soon.
Yeah, and he also has that quality that's similar to Herzl, of someone who presents as an educated European who is almost secular, just like you could pick anyone from Vienna or these capitals and he'd fit right in. And I think that there's always that kind of just like tragic tension there, that people are yearning for this big visionary project of getting Jews out while also appearing like they completely fit with European culture, that there would be no distinction. On the kind of style of the book, I found like a lot of the narrative had kind of the quality that if you're reading aphoristic philosophy or something, you do a lot of the imaginative work yourself as the reader. You know, if there's a small section, you kind of come away and your mind almost clicks into gear and creates these really, like, almost creates patterns. And I found a lot of the connections of the book really kind of surprised me. You mentioned the hurricane that devastated Galveston just a few years before Jews actually began to arrive there. And it's, like, impossible not to think of that as a kind of reverse metaphor for the kind of annihilation of the 20th century and annihilation of 20th century Europe and a kind of the a hope beyond hopelessness, I think, is what Thomas Mann calls what European history presents to both Germany and to Jewish identity. And these stories of resilience, but also of just like of collapse, basically run through the book. What surprised you most about like how readers have responded to the
book? I've never thought of that metaphor before. So it's so nice to hear people's new interpretations. As you said, you know, I hope that people sort of bring their own sort of imagination to it. Yeah, the book has no narrative voice in a way. My voice isn't in there. It's all interwoven primary sources from letters and from diaries and from speeches, from interviews that I've done, from old sort of oral history interviews. I thought it might be interesting to weave them together because I find when I'm reading a history book that the best moments are the source material, other quotes.
Yeah.
You don't really want something paraphrased. You want to hear it in the original voice, because sometimes I sort of think historians are lying if they're telling me something without I want to see their evidence.
Yeah.
So I decided to sort of interweave all these sources and let this book be told by those who were there rather than by some 21st century person who has no idea what she's on about.
But then as I finished the book, I reflected a bit on how tenuous our links to the past actually are, even to the past of our own families. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels, you use a quote from W.G. Sebald, who was in his novels as much as anything concerned with the idea of oblivion, how the 20th century has disappeared to some degree from the late 20th century mind. In a sense, the Jewish experience of the 20th century, even as we try and remember it all the time, we kind of lose sight of the personalities involved. And I felt like a lot of it depended on one relationship you have in the book with one of your interviewees and sort of hinges on one phone call. And, yeah, tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, the phone call you're talking about is to my dad's cousin, who was 90 at the time. It started because as I was reading online about my great-grandfather, who was called David Jockelman, I kept on finding references to another Jockelman, Emmanuel Jockelman. And I thought, who is this person? Is he related? You know, it's quite a rare surname in that spelling. And Emmanuel Jockelman was always referred to online as having this sort of pseudonym, Mjo Bashe, B-A-S-S-H-E. And I read that he was a playwright in New York, a sort of experimental playwright in the 20s and 30s, quite sort of ahead of his time, making these slightly strange avant-garde plays. And so one day I asked my dad, have you heard of this person, Mjo Bashe? He was a playwright and he might have been a distant relative of ours. And my dad said, oh, I know Mjo Bashe. She was 10 years older than me, and she was a New Yorker who came to visit after the Second World War. And I thought, this does not sound right. Eventually, I sort of unraveled the mystery, which is that there are two Mjo Bashes. Emmanuel Jockelman, who arrived in New York as a young boy, who changed his name to Mjo Bashe, and then had a daughter who he named Mjo Bashe II, who was born in 1930, and in 2020, when I sort of discovered her existence, was 90. Yeah. And I called her, I think, just before the pandemic started, in sort of January, February 2020, and asked her about her father, the original Mjo Bashe, and her grandfather, who's my great-grandfather, and also growing up in 1930s New York. And I sort of, you know, thought maybe she would tell me, you know, a few sort of vague memories, but she had the sharpest memory of anyone I've ever met. You know, she remembered more about her childhood than I remember about mine, even though mine was in the 90s and hers was in the 1930s. So she sort of forms the hinge of this book in the middle. And it's really the first point in the book where the book shifts from being told through written primary sources, you know, things like newspapers and diaries, to oral history told by a living person, sort of, you know, living memory. And then from then on, the book is mainly formed of interviews. So it's this point where the history turns from sort of, you know, dead history to living history.
Yeah. And it's sort of, I really got the sense that the past is the past. It really happened. But our sense of it is, so I think that's such a central human experience, that we feel that there's a lot of mystery at the heart of it as well. And that it depends on these small little interactions, which then expand through time. And yeah, I thought her father died quite young, isn't that right? And she has this beautiful bit where she talks about how there's always part of her mind which is sort of with her father, like is watching him in the kitchen or watching him in the study. And I think everyone can relate to these human stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly can't relate to the great narrative at its heart, but I certainly think that, you know, your story is massive resonance to anyone who is interested in how your family builds who you are and how bits of you are made by these like slightly odd, curious events that happened a century ago. But no, I absolutely love the book. I really recommend to our listeners to go and buy it and read it. And thanks, Rachel, for coming on. That was really fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me.